The Paranormal Podcast is brought to you by Gaia, the streaming TV service dedicated to exploring the cutting edge of metaphysics, ancient wisdom, and the unexplained, now with a new and improved website. The first month of your membership is 99 cents, so sign up today by going to Gaia.com/Jim. That's Gaia.com/Jim. Thanks, Gaia. The Paranormal Podcast is also brought to you by Scott Evest. Great clothing plus tons of pockets for your stuff. Well, that's Scott Evest. To learn more and get a super special Scott Evest deal, go to jimherald.com/vest. That's jimherald.com/vest. Click on the link I provide there and use the coupon code JIMHERALD, one word, no spaces, and you'll get 20% off your purchase. Thanks, Scott Evest.
This is the Paranormal Podcast with Jim Harrell.
Welcome to the Paranormal Podcast. I am Jim Harrell, and so glad to be back with you kind of over the turkey hangover of Thanksgiving. I hope you had a great holiday, and we are in the midst of the holiday season. So I hope you're having a great one, having a lot of fun, and a very blessed holiday indeed. And just because it's December doesn't mean we tuned out for the rest of the year. Or it's almost December, I guess I should say. But we are dedicated to bringing you the best of paranormal content, even during the holidays when other people's minds might be elsewhere. And we're going to start out today with an interview. Actually, you probably should have posted a couple of weeks ago, but we had a great opportunity to catch up with Linda Godfrey about her recent book, Monsters Among Us, a fascinating discussion of cryptozoology, then followed up by a filmmaker, Adam Tomlinson. We're going to talk about shadow people. It's all on this week's Paranormal Podcast, and here it is. This is a book that I think that you're going to enjoy learning about and the research behind it. It's called Monsters Among Us, an exploration of otherworldly Bigfoots, Wolfmen, portals, phantoms, and odd phenomena. The guest and the author is Linda S. Godfrey. And we're so glad to have her with us today. She's also authored Real Wolfmen and American Monsters. She's been on various television programs like the Sean Hannity Show. And, of course, she's been a guest on Coast to Coast AM. She's been on our show before. And we're so glad to have her with us again to talk about Monsters Among Us. Linda, welcome to the program.
It's great to be back. Thanks, Jim.
Now, what inspired you to write this book, this particular book?
Well, it happened that the last few years, it seemed like I was getting a lot of reports where it wasn't just the usual, you know, creature running along the road, stand up and scare the people, but there were other phenomena such as strange lights, UFOs, you know, just a weird variety of things that went along with these. And it started occurring to me that, you know, I might have been sort of editing some of these things out, not purposely in the past, but they didn't strike me as being necessarily associated. But when you get a great clump of them, you start thinking, there's something else going on. And if I don't pay attention to it, then I'm not truly investigating. I'm just kind of letting my own biases sweep me along. And, you know, that's not good reporting in my book. So, when I really thought about it, I had quite a few and others, you know, from the past that I hadn't really explored in that way and probably should have. And so what this book, the intent of this book was to show how prevalent these types of activities are in tandem with sightings of things like upright wolfmen, Bigfoot, and other things.
Now, that's the thing is, I think when most people think of cryptids, their mind immediately goes, I was just talking to somebody about this about an hour ago, the mind immediately goes to Bigfoot, but particularly in this book, there's a much richer palette, isn't there?
Right. Yeah, exactly. And it may be partly because I'm better known for the sightings of the upright wolfmen that I receive more of those. But it does have probably one of the most spectacular Bigfoot encounters I've ever read about anywhere, with a very, very credible who went on a pseudonym in the book, but may come forward. In fact, I have several of my major witnesses in the book wanted to have a pseudonym at letters, but they're all thinking of kind of coming forward and letting their names be known because they're also convinced of the importance of this kind of study.
Now, when we talk about these kind of things, I mean, I think for the longest time, the view was these are just different. First of all, either they're folklore or urban legends, mm-hmm. or they're animals we've not discovered yet. But
right.
It seems like that's kind of broadening now, and there are a lot of other possibilities what these may represent. Did you find that to be the case?
Yeah, and you know what you described is exactly the evolution of my own line of thought, because at first I was thinking, oh, it's just, you know, people making it up, myth, legend, folklore, when I, back at the newspaper in 91, 92, broke the original story about the Beast of Bray Road. And then as time goes on, you know, it occurred to me that there was more than one. They were all over the world. There had to be a reproducing population. So I started thinking along the lines of like what I call indigenous dogman, where something that was maybe a gray wolf or a hybrid of a dog and a wolf had just developed through natural selection larger paws, which made it easier to walk upright, easier to do things like carry a part of a small deer over your shoulder, that kind of thing. And then the more the reports piled up and piled up over the years, because this is 25 years now, and I still get reports from the U.S., Canada, South America, and even Europe.
The thing is that,
as you can see by the book, and oh no, please go ahead.
No, we're getting a little break up there, so I thought you had paused. I apologize. Go ahead and finish your thought.
I'm not sure where that thought went. I was going to say, as long as I'm still getting these, that's a lot. Do the math. There's a lot of sightings in those years, and it began occurring to me that while creatures running on their hind legs is not a supernatural act, any mammal can do it if trained to do so, there are other aspects. For one thing, it's not natural or usual. They don't do it unless they're trained or motivated by, say, loss of a limb. But then, over and over and over and over, people who see these creatures, even if they're just in the ditch or along the roadside, report they just seem to have this kind of very uncanny interest in them that you don't normally see, you know, if you encounter just, say, a bear or some other. You can tell they're deciding whether they want to eat you or whether you're going to hurt them, and that's about it. But, you know, but these things will look at people, and people feel that they're getting an actual message, not in the King's English, but clear enough that they can understand it, saying, I would come and get you. I know where you live. I would like to jump on the hood of your car. I could do that. You know, I'm better than you are, blah, 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 that kind of thing. And they sometimes do scrape or scratch people's cars, chase them for a small distance, sometimes keeping up with high speed. That kind of thing. Now, these are not normal actions of normal creatures. I mean, when's the last time you ran into, say, a deer or a coyote or even a dog and you felt you were getting a mental impression? And these are not from normally psychic people, by the way.
Right.
That it was going to, you know, jump on your car, or that it was better than you, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, that's a pretty fearsome thing if there's kind of telepathic communication that's a part of this.
Right, and that's how people characterize it. You know, and I always try and play devil's advocate myself. It's the old reporter's hat still on me. But I always think, well, maybe there was some sort of body language that we interpret or misinterpret and think that it's a message coming. But then compare it to seeing other animals in the wild, and people just don't usually say that sort. You know, they don't impute this feeling that they have in the same way to animals. And I mean, my husband's a hunter. He's had a bear go right under his tree stand. He's actually been stalked by a cougar, and never did he have that feeling that he was getting. He was scared, you know, in both incidents, but he didn't have any kind of feeling that it was telling him that it was better than he was.
Wow, I've never heard that one. That's kind of spooky. And just to note, as you're listening here, you'll notice Linda has kind of gone over to more of a phone signal. We're having a little problem with Skype, so we just moved over to that. I think we'll mine this fantastic wisdom that she has. Linda, in the book, there is an account, and it is really it's one of the wildest things I've ever heard about this woman who transforms into a beast. And not only does she do this, she does this during a church service. Tell us about that story, because that's chilling.
Yeah, and this was one that was really difficult for me to write. You know, and I mean, I always vet my witnesses as best I can, but these people I interviewed in person several times. I went over every detail of everything that they told me and, you know, verified anything that I could factually. And they seemed like salt of the earth, middle-aged couple. He's a former Vietnam vet, but you know, in great health and everything. So there was no possible reason to believe that they made this up, and they insisted on being being anonymous. They didn't want anything from it. So I have to set that out there first, because you need to know how reliable I felt they were before you hear this story. And I admit, this is probably one of the most shocking ones I've ever received in my life. So, and it has some really unsettling ramifications, you know. So I had to, you know, kind of decide what to put in and what not. But there was this couple, and this happened in 1992. So it was a couple of decades ago. And it was actually this couple and their two children were the eyewitnesses, along with a church, a small church full of people, although they and the woman in question were in the very front row, which was shaped like kind of a U. So most of the congregation didn't have a perfectly clear line of sight to it. But what happened was this lady that was kind of sitting across from them in the pew, they had said that all during the service, their eyes kept kind of being drawn to her. She was very just normal looking, you know, nothing unusual about her features or anything, just a very, very average looking person. But she seemed to be sort of twitching or uncomfortable. And at the moment that the pastor finished the sermon, which they said had been on the Holy Spirit, and he customarily would then walk down into the midst of the congregation to have the singing part of the service, she stood up from her pew and kind of twitched her neck and let out this unearthly howl, which just sort of galvanized everyone.
Wow.
And then almost instantaneously, they said, her clothing, her body shape, and everything just transformed, you know, it just sort of in the twinkle of an eye. It wasn't like one of these Hollywood scenes where everything is growing and contorting and you're watching muscles grow and pop and fangs grow and, you know, the claws come out. It was more of an instantaneous change, and she appeared to be this very large wolf-like creature, except that it had hooves instead of paws on all four limbs. And the pastor was right there at the moment, still had his Bible in his hand. And they said he kind of held it toward the creature and rebuked it. And there were elders up near the area, too. And several of them kind of piled on the creature all together so that it couldn't move or go anywhere. So you can see this still had, you know, flesh and blood and height and weight. It wasn't like a phantom that just sort of, you know, escaped their reach. And within a couple of seconds of having done that, it changed back to the woman form, and was led out of the church at that point. And I don't know if they continued with the song prayer. I can't remember, but the couple said that people were talking about it, kind of in whispers among themselves, but then it was never talked about after that. It was just let go. And there was supposed to have been, they videotaped all of their services to send to shut-ins, but the video for this particular service disappeared somewhere. It was never, he wanted to see the tape of a service, and it was not available. And it was just kind of a really strange event that kind of stuck with this couple and has puzzled them and bothered them all these years, you know. And the pastor moved on to a different place. The church, the building itself, where this took place, is no longer a church. Part of the building is gone. And so it's nothing anybody can go to and go in there and see or anything like that. You know, and I don't give the location because I wouldn't want people just to go to where the location is. But I can say that everything they told me about that checked out. So it's just a shocking sort of thing with a lot of implications if you think about it.
I mean, how do you explain something like that? What do you think?
Well, you know, it seems, I mean, it fits the idea of demons in appearance maybe being possessed by some sort of demon. And, you know, if you are a Bible-believing person or even many other world religion-believing person, there are supposed to be creatures who don't have our best interests in mind that are in other worlds. You know, I'm a Christian. We would call it, well, there are various names for it that you could all imagine. So was it something that was able to possess people? The fact that rebuking it and covering it with these elders, just covering it with their own bodies, and then it re-transformed back into the woman, makes you think that it was some sort of possession. You know, they said she didn't seem to have any characteristics of abnormal behavior or anything like that before that. She was fairly new to the congregation, and they didn't really know her well, but, you know, they had never seen anything like that about her. So it's really hard to say. And then she left the congregation, you know, of course, they moved away, and everything dissolved. So it seems sort of purposeful to me.
Interesting. Interesting. It is. And the tape disappearing, why would the tape disappear? Who would do that? Who or what, I guess I should ask, would do that? That's another strange wrinkle.
Well, I think it's that, from what I gathered from talking to them, was that their church had a policy that if things happened in church, say, you know, there was a service and someone maybe talked in tongues or, you know, had a prophecy or something, these things were considered part and parcel of the church service and was not anything to be made public. And they feel that this was just considered by everyone to be a private event that happened in their church, and that it was just kind of shut down. Now, if anything had shown up in that video, they wouldn't have wanted this to be distributed to shut-ins and other people to see it happening, you know, so I'm sure it was just more expedient to do away with it or hide it or something like that.
Interesting. And it is an interesting conversation we're having with Linda Godfrey. The book is Monsters Among Us, an exploration of otherworldly Bigfoots. And that's the way it's here on the cover, Bigfoots. I did mispronounce it. Wolfmen, portals, phantoms, and odd phenomena. And we'll be back right after this on the Paranormal Podcast. The Paranormal Podcast is brought to you by Gaia. This time of the year, instead of season's greetings, I guess these days I should be saying streaming greetings, because almost everyone will find a new streaming device in their stocking, whether it's a Chromecast, an Apple TV, a Roku, or if you've got a really big stocking, a smart TV. Now, all of those platforms are fantastic, but the question, the important thing is, what do you watch? Now, of course, you have all those great movie channels everyone knows about. The names are household names. I won't repeat them here. But what if you want the cutting edge of metaphysics, ancient wisdom, and the unexplained? Well, there is an answer, and that answer is Gaia, the streaming TV service dedicated to exploring the topics we love. And not only is Gaia great on streaming devices, but Gaia has a brand new website that has taken everything they do to the next level. You can enjoy your own personalized homepage and always have great recommendations ready to stream. You watch their shows with upgraded lightning-fast streaming. You'll experience their simplified navigation for easy discovery, and you can bookmark your favorite moments and mind-blowing new ideas with Gaia's Community Hearts feature. So you can stream Gaia anywhere. All these great devices, the great website, on apps on your devices, your phones and your tablets. It's fantastic. Regardless of the platform, you explore life's biggest mysteries from specialists in these areas on Gaia's exclusive programs with hosts like David Wilcock, Regina Meredith, and of course, George Norrie. It really is the way to go. I think that you will really enjoy Gaia, and it's a great time to join because the first month of your membership is only 99 cents, and you can cancel at any time. To mind the wisdom, be entertained, and enlightened, just go to Gaia.com/Jim. That is GAIA.com/Jim. To sign up for your first month, it's only 99 cents. You probably have that rattling around in your couch cushions. Check it out. 5,000 years of wisdom now streaming on Gaia. History like you've never seen it. That's Gaia. Thanks, Gaia. We're back on the Paranormal Podcast. Our guest is Linda S. Godfrey. She is the author of the new book, Monsters Among Us, an exploration of otherworldly Bigfoots, Wolfmen, portals, phantoms, and other odd phenomena, I added the other. Sorry about that. Linda, now, I love the way you have this book laid out and in chapters and in sections, and maybe in some ways that we wouldn't necessarily expect when we picked up the book. The first section fascinated me, this idea of worlds below. Now, cryptids, I usually think either they're in the sea, we think, or the ocean, or a loch like Nessie. Or they're like a Bigfoot who's walking around on the land, but they're monsters underground that people are seeing?
Well, you know, that idea, that notion of creatures coming up from the abyss or from somewhere below has kind of been popping up in my research from the very beginning. And, for instance, for years I've been hearing rumors about werewolves in the sewers of Minot. And, you know, I've never been able to substantiate that or find a witness, but every once in a while I hear that. There was another instance early in my research when I contacted a pet communicator, a pet psychic communicator, whom I'd heard had really amazing talents, and asked her to kind of home in on my drawing of the indigenous dogman. And she came up with what she said was like a master animal spirit of these creatures, and she sensed that it was in a cave, deep in a cave somewhere, and gave her this message, you know, just a very short right. message. So, you know, I'd always kind of had those things kind of playing at me, but never really stopped and looked at it all. And it's a very, very ancient idea that there are tunnels and things beneath the earth where these sorts of things can hide out. And I've also heard that in relation to Bigfoot, that a lot of people believe that they make their winter homes in, especially in caves and or holes in cliffs, that sort of thing.
Well, you mentioned Bigfoot, and I'll throw this out there about that particular creature, who is kind of like the I guess 500-pound gorilla, no pun intended, in the room. But people say, well, you know, Linda, there's no evidence of these things because we've not found DNA. We've not found a body. Mm-hmm. We've not found this. What do you say to those people who say that?
Well, you know, some people do believe that we have found DNA of Bigfoot. There was I'm not going to get into it, but there was testing done by mm-hmm. someone that was pretty big news, you know, in the crypto world for a while, but strict, formulaic, run-of-the-mill, scholarly methods weren't followed exactly along the whole thing. So, it threw a little bit of controversy in at it. And here's the thing anyway. Even if you would get good DNA that would say, well, this is some sort of primate, but we don't know what it is, it just proves that it's a primate that we don't know what it is, because we have no standard store of Bigfoot DNA to compare it to. You know, if you were looking for, say, mountain lion, say you had some nice fur,
right.
and you know, you wanted to prove that it was from a mountain lion, you could take it to an animal lab. They could do a test and say, yes, it exactly matches the mountain lion, and they could probably even tell you where it came from. You know, but we don't have that form of comparison for Bigfoot, no matter how great a sample we get. And with the dogmen, at least 90% or more of the sightings that I receive sound like they're just very large wolf or wolf-dog hybrids. And if you, in my view, if you did a DNA testing of them, you'd probably just get, oh, it's a wolf or a wolf-dog hybrid.
Mm-hmm.
But they don't show any other characteristics in most cases. So that makes it very difficult to try and prove them in that way. We do have footprints of both Bigfoot and the Dogman, very, very good ones. The Dogman prints look like very large wolf prints most of the time, with the claws showing and everything. They're usually, you know, at least 5 to 6 inches in diameter, which is, you know, very good size for a canine. So we have those. We have kind of blob squatches and blob wolves for photographs, and I think there are some valid reasons that we only get blurry shots of them most of the time. But to me, really, you know, what people say, well, anecdotal evidence is the weakest. In this case, I think it's probably our strongest evidence, because what's kept me going and driving me to keep studying this all these years is that we have hundreds and hundreds of witnesses, sane and sober people all over the world, who are describing pretty much the same thing. You know, and when they do differ, the differences still fall into certain categories, you know, that I can list and see. And there may be different types of creatures, but especially with the ones that just look like overgrown wolves or great big dogs, there's a great consistency not only to their looks but to their actions. And why would this be if there wasn't something behind it?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and we have other strange anomalies occurring with them. You know, that I've tried to point out in this book particularly. But those are the answers. And, you know, to me, you have to look at the witnesses, vet the witnesses, and then say, wow, these are a lot of, it's a wide variety of very reliable sounding people who have seen this many times, more than one person at a time, so we can rule out hallucinations. And sometimes there's more than one creature at a time. So that's probably about the best we can do at this point.
Getting back to the book and the various chapters in the book, as I said, you have the Worlds Below section. Then you have Neither Man Nor Beast, and we talked about that woman who very chillingly kind of turned into a beast.
Transformation.
And some other things there. Then you have a section in this one. This is where it gets spooky to me. Because, you know, I don't go out necessarily looking for Bigfoot or looking for a creature, and I don't spend a lot of time in rural areas. So, you know, the chances of me seeing something is probably a little bit less than somebody that does that a lot. However, apparently these things can visit you at your home, things that make house calls. Tell us about things that make house calls.
Well, yeah, and this is, it's kind of a variation of, many people have probably heard of the old hag.
Oh, yes.
of English folk tales, where something, you wake up in the night and something is either by your bed or pressing on your chest, that kind of thing. And the interesting thing is that it's not just things that look like very old women or men or gray-hooded humanoids. It's also things that look like very large wolves or phantom dogs. They remind me, in fact, of the many phantom dogs of the British Isles. But, of course, these things are actually, again, found all over the world. And they usually consist of people being awake or in a waking state. In one case, it happened to a man who there was sunlight streaming in. It was morning. He was up and walking across the hallway to use the bathroom, wide awake, when he turned around and saw one of these just a few feet away from him. And they're a little different from the other ones, which just look like big, shaggy wolf or wolf-dog hybrids. These are usually described as jet black, super muscly, with actual humanoid bodies that show shoulders and the paws, which are normally just described as elongated paws, will sometimes be seen more as like human hands. And then the ears are either very small and close to the head, or they're very tall with tufts on the ends, and remind people of the Anubis god from Egyptian lore, which was considered to be the god or the god of the dead, or the guide to the underworld.
That'll get you into thinking. Not something that I want to necessarily encounter. Yeah, because I think it's always one of the – you talk about the old hag. And I do a show called Campfire where people call in with their experience. And a lot of people have experiences, for example, in their bedroom, whether it's like an old hag type experience or a shadow person or those kind of things. And to me, those are the most chilling, the ones that happen, for example, in your bedroom. Because where right. in life do we truly let down our guard? I mean, walking around for the most part, we kind of keep our guard up. Even, you know, maybe when we're awake or watching television or something, we maybe have our guard up to a certain amount. But when you go to sleep, that's when you're saying, okay, I'm going to trust everything's going to be okay and I'm going to rest. And then to wake up and encounter something like this, truly, truly, truly frightening. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, yeah, and the interesting thing is that it really is all cultures, and I managed to find a really fascinating account and psychological study of a Hmong man, that's Hmong, and these people call these things the Dab Tsog, which means evil spirit.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. Are these the ones who die from the sudden death syndrome and actually die in their sleep because they're frightened to death?
And this particular man who was the subject of the study had one of these, a great hair-covered furry creature jumping on him while he was lying in bed in a house where other people were present just on the other side of his door, and none of them had the slightest idea that this was happening. And the psychologist who put this forth gave a quote that I thought was really, really interesting, when she said, "The perceived intrusion of a supernatural figure into everyday reality prevents the dismissal of the entire experience as merely an unconscious dream." In other words, they're seeing this creature interacting with them and their room as they know it. It's not, you know, in dream space, everything's kind of out of whack, and, you know, things are in odd places and the lights are wrong. In all of these cases, the people are awake enough to see the room, to see what's happening. They see, feel, sometimes smell the creature. Oftentimes there's a big smell of sulfur mm-hmm. associated with these things. And all of these things tell you, you know, this just ain't no ordinary dream.
Yeah, and that's the weird thing about a lot of these things. They have a smell to them, which you wouldn't necessarily think, but it's odd, and it adds to the overall creepiness of it all. Now, you go on, and I mentioned shadow people. In your next section, you talk about shadows and mists and other kinds of weird lights and things that you wouldn't necessarily equate with cryptids and those kind of things. Why did you decide to include that section?
Well, because some of the shadows look like large dogs or wolves in the outlines of them, except they're... people will describe them as looking like a two-dimensional cutout that moves like an animal, but there's no depth to it. And then many of the myths are associated with sightings of cryptids. So, and the whole myth thing is just a fascinating thing to me. I didn't realize that there were so many people who either see the air change color or take the form of very... sharply defined columns of mist. In one instance, a sheriff's deputy sitting in his squad car saw this big, solid-looking green mist come floating over a marsh. It went right through his squad car, stopped there, turned off all of the electronics. This was in an area with known Bigfoot sightings, I might add, where he happened to be parked, right next to a woods that was full of them. And then he watched it. It made a sudden right turn, went up the path into these woods, and then everything came back on in his car. And he had a missing time episode from that, that he estimated at about 45 minutes.
Wow. Wow. And that missing time, that's one of the freakiest things to me, because you wondered what happened to you. What happened to you during this time? And then in another section here, I think the final section of the book, you talk about out of thin air creatures, UFOs, and portals. And I'll ask you about this. You know, Stan Gordon, who I'm sure you're very familiar with and probably even know him, he's done work with the coincidence of UFOs and Bigfoot. Did you see anything like that? Any reports like that where you see maybe cryptids and ghosts, or cryptids and UFOs, or cryptids and other phenomena that we usually think of as in a different category?
Well, yes. And even though they aren't always apparent to the person who sees the cryptid, for instance, I think I mentioned earlier that I had this very long section devoted to kind of an amazing Bigfoot sighting that happened in Chicago. And when I went to investigate it, because one of the things I did with this book was anytime there was a solid enough date that I could go back in the UFO records, moon phase records, solar flare records, I did that and noted whether any of those things were present. And right about at the same time as this was occurring, this man's amazing encounter was occurring with the Bigfoot, I found a really well-documented instance very close by with two witnesses of a UFO that they saw just kind of traveling along quite low, and this is more the nuts and bolts type, not, you know, not just the ball of light, traveling quite low over phone cables or some type of electric wires, and then just kind of zooming off. And the man who had the Bigfoot sighting was just amazed that this was going on so close in both time and space to where his experience was.
I mean, this book, what have you learned from doing it? I mean, I assume that every time somebody does a major project like this, and I would say this is a major book. I mean, it's interesting. I got a copy of this maybe 4 or 5 months ago when it was in galleys. So it's a big deal. From a major publisher. So, I mean, I have to believe when you have a project of this weightiness that you come out thinking about things maybe a little differently than you did going in. Did that happen for you? And if it did, in what way?
Well, yes, it did. And it's mainly that it's changed the way I look at every sighting. I no longer kind of discount things or just sort of ignore things out of hand. Not that I did that a lot, but, you know, I can see where I occasionally did that before. You know, but it had to be kind of glaring and really obvious for me to include it. And now, you know, I'm much more willing to go and look for other incidents that were happening right there at that time, or other descriptions of strange lights, or whatever you may have, or even anomalies with the creature itself. For instance, I've got one dogman sighting, again, by a very well-respected husband and wife that were driving, so they both saw it. It came down a mountainside, jumped in front of the road, or in front of their car on the road, and it was glowing blue. All its hairs, everything was just bright, and it was a bright enough glow that he had watched it all the time he was driving along as it just kind of plowed through the undergrowth coming down the side of that mountain toward the highway. So, yeah, I'm looking for, and that's a glaring one where it is part of the cryptid, but I think it's just important to know what is around in the entire, and I've always noted what's in the habitat, what human structures and cultural objects are there, what the landscape is like, geological formations, sacred areas, etc. But I have not really combed the area for related anomalous phenomena, and I do that now.
Well, it's been a great discussion, and if you're into cryptids, you need to get this book. It's called Monsters Among Us with Linda S. Godfrey as the author. Linda, where can people get the book?
Well, you can go to lindagodfrey.com, which is my blog and website, for a book list and for a place to click. It's available at all of the online bookstores, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, brick and mortar, Barnes & Noble, and other bookstores. So it's pretty easy and available to find right now. And, you know, if you're at a loss, just go into one of the search engines and search for it using the title Monsters Among Us by Linda S. Godfrey. So there's a marvelous older book by the wonderful Brad Steiger that has a similar title, but they're quite different books, and I think that was out about 10 years ago. So put my name in, and then the right one will pop up.
Well, it's a privilege always speaking with Brad. He's been on the show several times, and it's an honor. And it's been an honor speaking with you. Also, I very much appreciate it. I wish you the best of luck. I think it's going to be great. And thank you for your time today on the Paranormal Podcast.
You're welcome.
It's always great to have Linda on the program. She has such great insight on the topic of cryptozoology. Next up, we're going to talk about shadow people right after this on the Paranormal Podcast. This podcast is brought to you by Scott eVest. Scott eVest is clothing for men and women packed with hidden pockets to securely and discreetly hold your tech gear and ghost hunting essentials. Now, I completely believe in Scott eVest. In fact, I'm wearing one right now. I have their gray cotton hoodie. It's got the handsome red zipper, and I am toasty warm and enjoying it, and I love Scott eVest. Now, Scott eVest, despite the name, is about more than just vests, although they have some great ones, and we're going to talk about one in a bit here. But they offer jackets, pants, cardigans, hoodies, and even specialty items like travel boxers and lab coats. And all their clothing is so high quality, it comes with a 2-year warranty and a $1,000 anti-pickpocket guarantee, something I just learned about and I think is very, very cool. And all clothing features a weight management system to distribute the added weight of your gear across your torso, and something they call the personal area network, which allows you to discreetly route charging cables from pocket to pocket or headphones from any pocket up to the collar. And one of my favorite pieces of Scott eVest clothing is the Quest Vest, and I have one and love it. They have it for men and women. It's got this neat fabric blend, 65% cotton, 35% nylon. And what that does, it makes the vest great for either temperate weather or layered over other clothing for maybe colder climes. It packs 42 pockets, most are hidden, for anything and everything you might need to carry around. Teflon treated for water and stain resistant. Great for ghost hunters, travelers, busy parents, drone enthusiasts, and all around busy people. And I got to tell you, it is a great, great gift. I got letters last year that people had given it for Christmas, and people, it had that wow factor. It's like, I've never seen this before. This is so, so awesome. So you need to take advantage of that. So go over to jimherold.com/vest, jimherold.com/vest. Click on the link there and use the coupon code JimHerold, one word, no spaces, for 20% off. That's JimHerold, and that will get you 20% off any of their items. It is fantastic. I love Scott eVest. I have several pieces of their clothing. Every time I see a Scott eVest package in the mail, I feel like a kid at Christmas. I absolutely love it. And I know that I'll be able to wear these pieces of clothing for years. They're just that good, just that high quality. I firmly believe in this product. I know you will too if you give them a chance. I think you should. Go to jimherold.com/vest. That's jimherold.com/vest and use that coupon code JimHerold for 20% off. Thanks, Scott eVest. Our guest today is Adam Tomlinson. Now, he's a listener to the programs, but he's done quite a bit of research in his own right on the subject of shadow people, and he's an experiencer as well. And he's also a writer, actor, and filmmaker whose film, The Man in the Shadows, explores the strange world of shadow people. Now, as I said, his interest was piqued after a lone, though memorable, shadow person experience and escalated significantly after he decided to make a movie on the subject. Despite having earned a law degree, he found the research process very difficult because of a conspicuous lack of information beyond anecdotes, lore, and questionable thoughts on sleep paralysis. But he's going to peel back the shadows a little bit for us. Adam Tomlinson is on the line. Adam, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
So, first of all, Let's define shadow people, because one thing that I think is interesting is, you know, for example, the Campfire podcast. When I started that program, you know, I expected ghost stories. I expected maybe cryptid stories, Bigfoot, Chupacabra, maybe some UFO stories, and kind of shadow people, which are one of the leading categories of calls we get, kind of blindsided me. I didn't expect that. So what exactly is a shadow person, shadow people? What are they? I mean, or how would you define, I guess, a shadow person experience?
Well, the shadow person that I deal with specifically in the film is the man in the hat or the hat man, although there's a few variations. Sometimes people see them wearing a cloak. Sometimes they have glowing red eyes or yellow eyes or no eyes at all. So it's a bit of a catch-all, but I tried to, during the film, to narrow it to, the man in the hat, though old hag experiences could follow under the umbrella of shadow people. I guess it would be experiences that tend to happen at night, and even though sleep paralysis I don't think is the explanation, it's often associated with the experience. So, it would be something that falls along those lines.
Tell us about your experience and how old you were. You, where were you, and what happened?
Well, it was fairly recently, about 7 years ago. And I would like to stress off the top that I don't take the fact that this happened as proof of anything. I think that's a easy way to quickly lose credibility, is just to claim I saw something, therefore it's real. But it was, it really was amazing, just because it fell so far outside the boundaries of a normal experience. What happened was, I was living in Toronto at the time, whereas I am now, and I was having a nightmare, and it was a horrible nightmare. There was a man in a hat. He was following me. It was dark. I was in an alley or somewhere, and it was a very lucid dream. But at some point, I realized, okay, I'm dreaming. I know how to get out of this. I can deal with this situation. So I did that thing you do where you just pull yourself out of a dream. And I opened my eyes, and the man in the hat was there, like in my room. And as far as I was concerned, he was an actual person with presence, with a very just kind of evil air about them. Although the fact that someone was just appeared over my bed, I guess I'm not going to assume they're good. But I did feel a distinct sense of malice. So I was frozen momentarily, whether it was for fear or sleep paralysis, I'm not sure. Then I jumped up, kicked at the hat man, and he just sort of disappeared. Almost, the image was almost like in the original Star Trek, when someone gets beamed up to the Enterprise and they just sort of fade away. And I remember waking up the next morning, and you'd think I just instantly run to the internet and think, okay, what is this? But I just sort of dismissed it and just put it to the back of my mind and thought, okay, that's weird. And it wasn't until about 2 months later, when I was hanging out with a friend of mine, we were just, you know, shooting the breeze and having a talk. And at some point he's like, you know, I've never told anybody this, but once my grandma's a guy in a hat, and he told his story, and I was like, what's going on here? I felt like I was in a horror movie. And only then did I go home and went on to Google and typed man plus hat plus nightmares, and there's, you know, 77 million hits or something. And, you know, he had a Wikipedia page, and it was just mind blowing. So I was like, okay, I need to learn a little bit more about this. And when I decided to make a movie, it just seemed like a no brainer that this is the topic that I was going to pursue.
Yeah, it certainly makes sense. They say, you know, write what you know. And I guess it would extend certainly to writing a film and producing a film. In your research, I mean, what surprised you? What kind of things did you find?
Well, what surprised me right off the bat was that even though there seemed to be fairly widespread awareness of this phenomenon, that looking to any remotely academic literature, there is nothing. Like, absolutely nothing. And part of it might have been I was just with the search terms or whatever, but the information was so conspicuous by its absence that I had to look more towards like the conspiracy bookshops and finding books written by people who might be crazy. I don't know, but that was, they were the only people who were talking about it. And that's what sort of led me gradually to someone who'd say, well, maybe they're a multidimensional being. So then I'd be like, okay, what do higher dimensions look like? So then I took a more scientific approach and learned about parallel universes and higher dimensions and things like that. Really, I found most of the research process about shadow people was not directly about shadow people, because it dried up very quickly. There's a lot of anecdotal evidence, but no one really has any well-founded explanation as to what they are. And looking towards that explanation, it made me realize the severity of the problem and just how fascinating it is and how connected it is to so many other things, potentially.
Now, in the movie, now is this is kind of a it's based on a real story. I mean, but there was some pretty extreme stuff in there. I looked at the trailer. I mean, did these kind of extreme things happen to you? What were some of the examples that were in the movie that either happened to you or maybe happened to someone you knew or had researched or spoken with?
Well, there's really two parts of that. The main character and some of the things that happened, it's in a way, it's an amalgamation of a lot of the stories I've read. But what I found out from just researching online and reading books about people's shadow person experiences, they were all fascinating, but they were all so similar that I didn't really think or didn't really know if there was enough to go on to make a full film. And it wasn't until I was in a coffee shop having just a conversation with a friend, much like the conversation we're having right now. And we were chatting, and there was this guy on another table, and he was just looking mm-hmm. at me. He's looking at me. And as we were about to leave, the guy just stood up, and he's like, "They'll ruin your life. They'll take your money. They'll take your relationships. They'll take everything." And my friend's like, "Oh, crazy guy." But one, I felt horrible for this guy. But two, I was like, how is that possible? And then I realized this is the guy who isn't posting his story online. This is the extreme story. And then I thought, that's the story I want to tell, how that guy became that guy. So it really starts out the film with an experience much like mine. The protagonist lead character named Rachel. She's mid-20s, a millennial photographer, just trying to figure out life, recently married. And it just starts with her having an experience very much like the one I just described, myself happening. And then it's her trying to figure out what this is before it destroys her. So in a lot of ways, it parallels my experience and then my research process trying to find out what happened. Then we do take some artistic liberties, but I really wanted to create the feeling of what it's like to deal with this and for people to finish watching the movie and sort of get a sense of what it's like, to complement a lot of the more research-based academic work that that you would hear more often say on this podcast. I feel like fiction and putting the meat on the bones. I even find with if I wanted to learn about Nigeria, I'd read a novel about
right.
Nigeria as well as a textbook. So, and I think so that was my main goal, is just for people to leave the theater, if it's a theater, or watch the DVD and think, man, this could happen to me tonight. And that's, to me, what's the scariness of it. To me, knowledge is scary.
Yeah, so, that's truth. Sometimes ignorance is bliss, isn't it? Now, it's interesting. Now, you've taken this movie to festivals, and it seems like some of the most interesting part of the whole experience has not been only the movie, but the Q&A after. What has been your experience with the Q&A after?
Oh, the Q&A has been amazing. They'll go on for 45 minutes, and it's just people asking questions a lot like you're asking, but not just that, but telling me their own stories. And what I've found with this is people think it only happens to them, and it's a terrifying thing. and just to think, oh my, am I haunted? Am I crazy? So when people see the movie and they see me up there speaking about shadow people objectively and without judgment, it's you know, and they'll come and talk to me afterwards and they'll say, you know, that one, that was accurate and I liked it. And two, just, you know, they're almost appreciative, which is something I didn't really anticipate, but which was great.
So here's a question for you, and this is not an easy one.
Okay.
What do you think the shadow people are?
That's actually, at this point, I would say that's an impossible question, but here is my best guess.
Okay.
Starting with the most simplistic sort of beginning, the easiest way to think of it is, say it's a hallucination. Now, I don't know if this is, but this is the most mundane example. So a hallucination hijacks the same parts of the brain that are used in actual perception. So if someone says they actually saw something, well, they did see something. So if you use that as a starting point, it does explain how it might appear and how all this works. But that then leads to a broader question, and this is where every single theory falls on its face. It's why does he look the same to everybody? Because hallucinations, by their nature, are an individual experience. Two people can't hallucinate the same thing at the same time. That's
right.
Not how it works. Unless there's some sort of collective consciousness where this archetype of the Hat Man, and this could explain a lot of paranormal phenomena, like Bigfoot, Greys, whatever, that there's this collective ether almost, and this has been demonstrated through the electromagnetic field and how it absorbs information. And it even ties into with the idea that consciousness is non-localized and that it exists outside of our mind. So that there's this larger sort of conscious world that we're all connected to, and this is where we pull that Hat Man image out of. So does that make perfect sense?
No. I get what you're saying, though. I get what you're saying. I think we tend to, and I was just saying this the other night on another interview, I think that I'm coming to the conclusion that we oversimplify this stuff. We think it's a ghost or a dead person or an evil spirit, and it may be. I'm not saying that these various things that we see aren't, but we shut off our mind to other possibilities. And one of those possibilities that is fascinating is kind of tapping into some kind of collective consciousness and experience some kind of archetype. And it's interesting, totally disconnected to our call today. In my Campfire 5 book, the editor of the book, Ron Hood, contributed a story about seeing a Hat Man, kind of shadow person, in a sports stadium. Or in like a, I think it was like a school stadium or something like that. And it was interesting because he said he wore a fedora. So, I mean, this does, you know, you hear of these accounts and it is fascinating. Now, here's another thing that really fascinates me about the shadow people. I want to see if it maps to your experience and what you've heard. People say that when they see a shadow person many times, it is the darkest of dark shade of black they've ever seen. In other words, it's almost like someone has cut a hole in the universe and they're just seeing total blackness. Is that map with your experience and that of others?
In terms of my own experience, I don't recall that exactly, but it absolutely, it jives with almost everything I've heard. And it's always the same expression, blacker than black. There's really no word in the English language to describe this other than that somewhat awkward phrase. But I also find that it ties in just to the notion that they're almost universally regarded as evil or malevolent, which to me is really strange because that's not an instinct that's activated very often. You know what I mean? There's not very often in life where you meet someone and just know intuitively they're evil. Yet that seems to happen all the time with shadow people. And I don't know if that's connected to the darkness, but the idea of darkness and evil and just misery really ties into all of this, because then there's the other explanation of what do shadow people want, and it's the idea that they feed off negative energy. So whether or not that ties into the actual color of the absence of light, the blackness. I'm not really sure, but it seems to be a theme for sure.
What is the weirdest experience that you think you've heard? It could be something that happened to you or somebody else.
The weirdest experience, it concerns one of the few examples where the shadow person did some good, and it was providing a warning. I forget if I was speaking to someone, if I read about it. I think I read about it. But the shadow person warned him that his father was going to get stabbed. And several days later, his father was in a cab or something, and the cab driver had a knife. But he'd told his father, and he was prepared for it, and ended up saving his father's life. Now, that's just one example, and that's one of the difficulties with researching this, is everything pretty much is anecdotal. But that also ties in with the idea of dreams being able to have some sort of predictive ability. I found this with prior to like a geological event or like a tsunami, where people have dreams about a tsunami. So that's, I thought that was interesting, because it ties in shadow people to other strange dream-related phenomena, which I thought was pretty interesting. But just the fact that the stories are so similar is what, to me, makes it interesting. Just because it just completely eliminates the idea that it's just a shadow or just someone's imagination or just in their head. It's definitely something that's happening.
Now, you mentioned when you researched this movie, you got some kind of universal pushback or weird things happened. Now, that's always interesting to me, because I think it was Nietzsche who said something like, when you stare into the abyss, sometimes it stares back.
Right.
Did the universe conspire against you making this movie? What kind of weird things happened?
Well, one of our producers, two of them actually, one of our producers, her father had a stroke right before we were getting ready to film, which I don't know if that's a coincidence or whatever, but that was something that put a huge wrench into things. He's doing much better now, thank goodness. But, I'm sure that's probably just a coincidence, but now that you bring it up, I'm not really, who knows how the universe works. The director afterwards mentioned having a shadow person experience, but interestingly, he told me that he didn't really feel that weird, because as he explained, he's like, I just made a movie about you. I know who you are. I don't have to worry about you. So I thought that was kind of neat, that the idea that knowledge of this could be empowering, which I guess knowledge usually is.
Do you feel that shadow people are psychologically more damaging, or do you think they can actually do real physical harm?
Well, I think it's definitely psychological, but I think also that in extreme cases, the psychological harm can lead to physical harm, and that's sort of the direction I took the film, just because, it is a horror type of thriller, and we certainly didn't turn it into a slasher or anything. That's just not remotely what I'm interested in, but that's what I got from the screaming man at the coffee shop, just the idea that it can get a lot worse. And just for people who haven't experienced it, I mean, the level of fear and terror is so much greater than anything, at least I've ever experienced. I mean, I've been in like car accidents, whatever, that's scary. But this, the shadow person terror, is just at an entirely different level, because it combines a person being in your room, them being black in this creepy costume, and the fact that just the sense of your worldview collapsing, being like, okay, well, I guess people can follow me from my dreams now. And to experience that on a regular basis, let alone a constant basis, I can see why people would do harm to themselves for sure. I just can't imagine. It just sounds awful.
Well, it is absolutely, the idea is terrifying. And this is one of the reasons that I think these visitations at night, in particular in your bedroom, are some of the most frightening. When you think about it, when do we let our guard down? When do we really in life let our guard down? And that's when you're getting ready to go to bed. You know, you go to bed, you relax, you know, you've had a tough day and it's like, ah, I'm finally in kind of my sanctuary here, my private place. I'm relaxed. It's kind of like when it reminds you of like a dog when they kind of lay on their back and, you know, their paws are up in the air, you know, they're right. Kind of relaxed and they let you let your guard down, right? So you're at your most vulnerable. You're perhaps asleep or about ready to go to sleep, and all of a sudden you see this dark intruder, this shadow intruder. I think that kicks it up a notch or two.
Oh, it certainly does. And I think that ties in with another trend, which is that they seem to appear before people who are experiencing mental illness, particularly schizophrenia. It's associated with drug use, alcohol, fatigue, just anything that involves weakening yourself or this is a perfect expression, even though it sounds extremely non-sciencey and way out there, but giving away your power. It seems that anytime someone's in a situation where they're giving away power, that opens them up to this kind of experience. So what that connection is, I really can't say. It's just really unfortunate that, you know, talk about kicking someone when they're down. It just seems to happen at the worst possible time.
Has the shadow person phenomena, has it haunted you? I mean, do you go, I mean, is it like your director? Is the process been kind of cathartic, or is it something you have in the back of your mind? Is he going to visit me tonight?
No, it's been more cathartic than anything. And it's just become, I'm just now having gone into it as far as I have, I'm just so curious just to find out what the answer is. So it's kind of weird. I've almost become in a way disassociated from the actual fear associated with it, which is why it was good to make the movie. And now I'm, working on a book as well, just because I just, you know, there's just so much more to tell surrounding this, from just so many different points of view. And, it's definitely been a cathartic experience for me and hopefully for people, you know, who it's happened to. I mean, my goal for people who aren't familiar with this is to see the movie and be more scared. And for people who have had the experience to be less scared because they're like, okay, this doesn't mean anything necessarily other than that. This is just something that happens to me. It doesn't make them any more, you know, crazy than having a bad dream or whatever kind of thing. But I think it's happening more and more. And I think the more it happens, I think there's going to be a tipping point where at some point this is just like widely known in pop culture, which is, you know, I'm kind of hoping since I made a movie about that. But to me, it's just so unique and interesting that, I just got to, I just keep wanting to learn more about it.
Do you think that we'll get to the bottom of it? I mean, that's one of the frustrating things about these, you know, these things is I've been doing this for 11 years. And last night I talked to Tim Beckley, who is a publisher of many, many books on the subjects. And he's written for many magazines and things over the years. He's been investigating this stuff 50 years. And basically his comment was something like 50 years of confusion. Do you think, and I only have 11 years of confusion, although I've been interested in this stuff since I was a little kid. Do you think there might be answers out there, or do you think it's just destined to be a mystery?
Well, I think there's definitely answers out there. The problem is we might not be equipped to understand them in the exact same way a dog isn't equipped to program a computer. I mean, we're bags of water who are designed to walk around eating berries. Maybe we just don't have the hardware, the software to be able to comprehend these mysteries of the universe. But On the other hand, I do feel like we're getting closer because all of the possibilities, whether they're, you know, different versions of parallel universes or higher dimensions or caused by electromagnetic interference with the brain, we're learning more and more about the possible explanations. So I think we'll at least be able to start rejecting possibilities. But one avenue that has, I think, has a lot of potential, at least as a starting point. I don't know if you're familiar with Michael Persinger.
Yes. I think we've had him as a guest on the programs, but it's been years ago, I believe.
Right. Well, he's a fascinating guy, and he wrote a book called Neuropsychological Basis for God Beliefs, where his argument is that in a related thing, near-death experiences where people would say have a vision of Jesus – it's his idea that this is just a hallucination that the brain invents in order to make the passage to death more pleasant. And he tried to prove this by undertaking experiments called the God Helmet experiments, where he'd put a helmet on someone's head that would have electrodes that would shoot just mild but carefully calibrated electrical frequencies into their brain, which could induce these kind of visions that that we're talking about, or even manipulate someone's feelings so they could feel better or worse. And I think where this ties in terms of a broader potential explanation, I mean, if you just look around where you are right now, there's electricity everywhere. You know, there's electromagnetic waves coming from your computer. There's radio waves. There's TV signals. There's all this electromagnetic interference. I heard one figure that we're bombarded with 50 million times more electromagnetic energy than 100 years ago. And nobody really has a clue what the effect this is going to be. So it's quite possible that the more electricity that's just surrounding us, the more it's going to be influencing what we see, what we feel, and what we experience. So there's that. And there's also, you look at what we do know, the connection to dreams. So now you start thinking, well, what are dreams? The way the brain is when we're sleeping is very similar to the way it is when people are astral projecting or meditating or taking LSD, even. It sort of opens up the mind's third eye to, you know, travel around the world, so to speak. But the way that can happen, and again, this gets into stuff Dr. Persinger has worked on, there is that electromagnetic soup all around us that not only do we potentially draw on for, you know, storing our memories, but it's also what connects us. Whether it be
you dropped out there for a minute.
Just
repeat that last sentence or two.
Well, just talking about the connection we have through the electromagnetic field, which again, you can if people want to Google Persinger stuff, it's fascinating. But we do have that kind of connection. For instance, you've probably heard stories where someone, like a loved one, has died and someone has felt it in their stomach, and this happens all the time. And that's just because I believe, and I can't really think of any other explanation, it's just that connection we have through our environment. So again, this doesn't really provide any answers, but I think it's just by looking at that kind of material, I think we're getting closer to a possible answer, to at least answer how we perceive these things, let alone, you know, what they are. But I don't know. I think give it some time. We'll crack the code eventually.
Well, actually, I looked it up, Dr. Persinger. I've heard of his work, but we have not had him on the show. We actually had a gentleman by the name of Matthew Alper, who did a book called God Part of the Brain. So I guess I am confused. But what I am doing right after this, we're going to send a quick note to my intrepid assistant, Maddie. We're going to try to get Dr. Persinger on one of the shows. So we're trying to rectify that. And it's funny, you know, you do 11 years of shows and you kind of look at it and say, oh, we've gotten all the people, you know, all the major people. And then all of a sudden you go, how can I miss that person?
Right,
so thank
right.
you for that. Thank you for that. Well, Adam, a very important question, and I really appreciate this discussion of shadow people, is where can people find more information about your work or the film or both? How can they view the film?
Well, the film is going to be available on fanexperience.ca, fanexperience.ca. And what that is, it's a website that usually works with bands and musical groups to have, you know, VIP kind of things. But what we're trying to do is come out with the DVD, and at the same time, I want to have a novel on the subject available. We're going to have, you know, t-shirts and stuff. And just the idea is to make it something that people would want to get for a gift or someone who's really, really interested in the paranormal, because I've really tailored everything to people who really want to know. I didn't, you know, dumb down anything trying to find like a wide audience. I just want people to really appreciate what this is. So, and you can also go to our Facebook page, the Man in the Shadows Facebook page, and themaninetheshadows.ca, our website. So information for that will be available. Everything's going to be coming out on November 1st. And we're going to have everything ready for basically the idea is to have this as a Christmas type of thing. Because I understand that people don't buy DVDs necessarily every day, but we've tried to make it a big enough of thing that, you know, people would be happy to, you know, to give or receive something like that.
Well, I've enjoyed the conversation. We certainly wish you the best with the film, The Man in the Shadows. Adam Tomlinson, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
Well, I hope that you enjoyed that edition of the Paranormal Podcast as much as I did, and I hope that you'll join me next week for more paranormal spookiness and fun and fascination. I love what I do, and I love that you listen to it, so I thank you so much. Please tell a friend, and we'll talk to you next time on the Paranormal Podcast. Have a great week, everybody. Happy holidays. Now for the legal disclaimer. We do not accept money from publishers or content producers in exchange for interviews. However, as with most media outlets, in the majority of cases, we do receive complimentary copies of books and DVDs that we feature on our podcasts. Your purchases of books, DVDs, and other items via our Amazon.com links benefit Jim Harold and JimHarold.com and help us continue our programming. The sponsor messages you hear on the programs are paid endorsements, although we really do like them. For the full disclaimer, go to JimHarold.com, and thanks for listening.